May I welcome you to session number 223, is entitled Faithful Scholarship and the Mainstreaming of Mormon Studies. And may I remind you that it's time to turn off cell phones and other noisemakers. We have two presenters today. The main paper will be given by John Charles Duffy. Many of you know John Charles. He's spoken at a number of previous symposia and has published several times in Sunstone and other publications. John Charles is currently a doctoral student in religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He holds a BA in English from Brigham Young University. He taught for 9 years in the writing program at the University of Utah. One of his most interesting publications that you might want to be aware of is called Defending the Kingdom, Rethinking the Faith, How Apologetics is Reshaping Mormon Orthodoxy. That's in Sunstone of May of 2004. His paper on faithful scholarship and the mainstreaming of Mormon studies will be responded to by Brian Birch. Brian is currently the director of the Religious Studies Program and the chair of the Philosophy and Humanities Department at Utah Valley State College in Orem. After completing a bachelor's and master's degree in philosophy from the University of Utah, he attended Claremont Graduate University, where he received a PhD in the philosophy of religion and theology in 1998, with his emphasis being around the philosophical, theological, and ethical dimensions of religious pluralism. So with that brief introduction, I will turn the time over to John Charles, who will take a good portion of the time, and then we'll have a response by Brian and hopefully some time for questions from you.
For those sitting in the back, there are handouts on chairs up at the front as a way of luring you closer forward. During the past half decade, Mormon studies has taken unprecedented steps toward recognition as a subfield within the academic study of religion. While some university presses, notably Illinois, began publishing Mormon studies series in the 1980s, only in the 21st century have some non-LDS universities in the United States added courses on Mormonism to their curricula. The profile of Mormon studies has been raised further by conferences at elite institutions like Yale Divinity School and the Library of Congress. The most important steps toward institutionalizing Mormon studies in the academic mainstream are efforts to create programs or endow professorships currently underway at Utah Valley State College, Utah State University, and most famously, Claremont Graduate University. Mormon studies has been pursued since the 1960s primarily by Mormon scholars speaking to Mormon audiences. Institutionalizing Mormon studies within the non-Mormon academy means creating contact zones, where Mormons and non-Mormons work together to develop new discourses about Mormonism. Various interests and agendas flow into these contact zones. Non-LDS faculty and administrators have their own reasons for pursuing Mormon studies, which may or may not coincide with the reasons for which Latter-day Saints promote Mormon studies. Taking Mormon studies mainstream is a process of negotiating among the various interests that flow into the contact zones. Scholars within the Mormon world bring a variety of assumptions and agendas to the study of Mormonism. Some of these have been more influential than others in shaping how Mormon studies is done in mainstream academic institutions. The most influential Mormon interests have been those associated with the term faithful scholarship, or cognate labels such as faithful history, believing history, the perspective of faith, and so on. I will define faithful scholarship more precisely in a few moments, but simply put, faithful scholarship is scholarship predicated on LDS orthodoxy. By orthodoxy, I mean affirmation of the historical reality of LDS faith claims, of the Church's exclusive claim to divine authority, and of the obedience owed to Church leaders. Orthodoxy encompasses a certain diversity of belief and practice, and its boundaries are not sharply defined. Nevertheless, orthodoxy has been enforced as normative within the LDS Church, which means that most LDS-identified people operate within its boundaries. Given that most Latter-day Saints are Orthodox, it perhaps comes as no surprise that faithful scholars and their supporters have been the dominant LDS players in the ongoing efforts to mainstream Mormon studies. However, faithful scholarship's dominance is not inevitable. It is rather the consequence of particular historical turns that, hypothetically at least, might have gone differently, and it is maintained in the present by Orthodox saints' strategic use of the rhetorical, financial, and political resources at their disposal. In this presentation, I will offer a very quick overview of the history of how faithful scholarship came to be the dominant LDS influence in Mormon studies, and I will gesture to some consequences of that influence, both for the future of Mormon studies and for the future of faithful scholarship. Let me warn you that this is going to be a whirlwind tour of four decades of sometimes complicated intellectual politics. So hold on to your hats, follow along on the handout, and you might want to take note of points you'd like me to elaborate on in the Q&A. First, let me offer a more concrete definition of faithful scholarship. The term came into vogue in the 1980s and 90s as a way to describe certain ways of uniting academic training with commitment to the LDS Church. Faithful scholarship does not name a clearly defined school or methodology, but it does point to an orientation or approach toward scholarship distinguished by the following characteristics, which you see on your handout. One, it seeks to represent a distinctively LDS perspective. In practice, this means that it presupposes orthodox convictions, such as the antiquity of the Book of Mormon. Two, it rejects the ideal of objectivity in scholarship, often on the authority of postmodern theorists. Three, insists that Mormonism be understood in its own terms. Faithful scholars have tended, for instance, to want to press the dilemma that Joseph Smith was either a prophet or a fraud. Four, speaks of faith and scholarship as fundamentally harmonious. The import of this move is to assert the intellectual credibility of orthodoxy and the value of using scholarly tools to understand the faith. Faithful scholarship has come to be associated with particular institutions. BYU Studies and Farms both use faithful scholarship rhetoric in articulating their missions, as did the Smith Institute prior to its recent dissolution. Support for faithful scholarship also comes from BYU Religious Education, the Family and Church History Department, and LDS Public Affairs. Faithful scholarship is distinct from the New Mormon history, for reasons we'll see in a few moments. In addition, it stands apart from scholarship published in Sunstone, Dialogue, or Signature Books of a kind that attracts labels such as liberal or revisionist. Sunstone and Dialogue occasionally publish works of faithful scholarship, but Orthodox scholars are likely to view Sunstone and Dialogue as unsafe forums in which to publish. Deciding who counts as a faithful scholar is tricky. Leonard Arrington and Eugene England would both have insisted that they were faithful church members, but neither one exemplified the faithful scholarship orientation I just outlined. Both were too wedded to objectivity as a scholarly ideal and too closely affiliated with Sunstone and Dialogue. For the most part, faithful scholars are those who affiliated during the 1990s and beyond with the institutions that use faithful scholarship rhetoric to define their missions. By this criterion, the label would apply to John Welch, Louis Midgley, Daniel Peterson, Noel Reynolds, Grant Underwood, Ron Esplin, Jill Durr, Richard Bushman, Richard Turley, and Robert Millett, among others. The label also applies to Terrell Givens. Other scholars have affinities with faithful scholars, but don't quite fit into that category themselves, perhaps because they evince tendencies that the Orthodox might see as liberal, or because they're simply not interested in working from an overtly LDS perspective. These scholars would include Philip Barlow, Kathleen Flake, and Armin Moss. Scholars who clearly stand outside faithful scholarship, either because their work is too revisionist or because their own religious views are too heterodox, would include D. Michael Quinn, Claus Hansen, Newell Bringhurst, Margaret Toscano, and Thomas Murphy. It should be noted that that's a very diverse crowd. The orientation that came to be called faithful scholarship gradually attained coherence between the 1960s and the 1990s. During the 60s and 70s, Latter-day Saint scholars first started talking about making distinctively LDS contributions to their disciplines. That, of course, being one of the defining characteristics of faithful scholarship. However, the most visible area of Mormon scholarship during this period, which was usually called the New Mormon History, was dominated by an orientation that represented the opposite of the four distinguishing characteristics of faithful scholarship I identified earlier. That orientation was articulated chiefly by Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander. Its characteristics were as follows. Again, you see this on your handout. The New Mormon history sought common ground with non-LDS scholars to understand as scholars of any faith or no faith would seek to understand. It aspired to be objective, by which the New Mormon historians meant that they wanted to transcend pro and anti-Mormon polemics. It sidestepped questions about the truthfulness of supernatural claims, and it called the saints to give greater recognition to the human in their history. And finally, it spoke of faith and scholarship as being in tension, These scholars expected to find conflict between what they called denominational prejudice and events as they actually happened. The New Mormon history came under attack during the 1970s from instructors in the church educational system and a trio of apostles with strong anti-modernist and anti-intellectual sentiments, Ezra Taft Benson, Markey Peterson, and Boyke Packer. Packer's landmark 1981 address, "The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect," denounced the New Mormon history's quest for objectivity, its emphasis on the human, and its efforts to bracket off supernatural claims. In the 1980s, BYU political scientists Lewis Midgley and David Bohn translated Packer's prescriptions into the language of philosophy, invoking the authority of the anti-foundationalist turn then underway in the humanities — that's fancy theory talk — Midgley and Bohn blasted the New Mormon historians' pretenses of objectivity. They called on LDS historians to reject secular or what they call positivist explanations and to write Mormon history in orthodox terms. Midgley and Bohn's attacks on the New Mormon history were one of several developments that polarized the LDS intellectual community during the 1980s. Another polarizing development was the scandal created by the Hoffman forgeries. The controversy over how to understand documents like the Salamander Letter showed that some LDS scholars were more open than others to revising canonical versions of Mormon history. Around the same time, junior apostles Neil A. Maxwell and Dallin H. Oaks encouraged scholars affiliated with the Smith Institute, BYU Religious Education, and the rapidly up-and-coming farms to produce scholarship that would, in Maxwell's words, protect our flanks, for example, by marshaling arguments in defense of the Book of Mormon's antiquity. Among the critics about whom Maxwell was concerned were Mormon revisionists, such as George D. Smith and Brett Metcalf. The latter half of the 1980s saw a dramatic increase in writing by individuals, not all of them with academic credentials, who claimed LDS identities but challenged the historical authenticity of LDS scripture and the church's teachings about the roles of women and about homosexuality. At the beginning of the 1980s, the chief divide in Mormon intellectual politics was between the New Mormon history and the anti-modernism of CES. You see this represented in a graph on the back of your handout. By the end of the 1980s, additional camps had emerged. To the left of the New Mormon historians, there were now vocal groups of revisionists, feminists, and gay advocates, the three great threats to the church famously identified by Boyke Packer in 1993. Between the New Mormon history and the anti-modernism of CES were the anti-positivist arguments of Midgley and Bohm, and the work being produced, especially at farms, by the cohort that Maxwell called faithful Latter-day Saint scholars. This faithful scholarship, as it was coming to be called, differed from the New Mormon history in that it was overtly grounded in orthodox LDS presuppositions rather than seeking common ground with non-Mormon scholars. At the same time, faithful scholarship differed from the devotional study promoted at CES because it engaged with mainstream academic disciplinary scholarship in ways that anti-intellectual voices in CES were afraid would undermine faith. In the course of the 1990s, faithful scholarship emerged as the dominant model for LDS scholars, marginalizing all rival orientations. Despite criticism from within CES, Farm's success at defending orthodoxy and winning a good name for the church, especially through its contributions to Dead Sea Scroll scholarship, did much to convince church leaders and church members of the value of faithful scholarship. The debate between anti-positivists and the New Mormon history ended after 1994, with the anti-positivists taking the last word. A succession of controversies in the 1990s clarified and enforced the boundaries of orthodoxy in ways that placed revisionism beyond the pale. These included attacks by Farms on Signature Books anthologies, the First Presidency Statement on Symposia, the exposure of the Strengthening Church Members Committee, and the September 6 excommunications. The stigma that came to be attached to Sunstone Dialogue and Signature Books as a result of those controversies encouraged LDS scholars to do their work in venues associated with BYU, Farms, the Smith Institute, and BYU Studies, thus enhancing those venues' importance as centers for Mormon scholarship. The normative force of faithful scholarship was further strengthened by BYU's academic freedom controversy, in the course of which faithful scholarship rhetoric was used to define the university's mission. Faithful scholarship's dominance over rival orientations was the result of intense contestation, including exchanges of insults, threats of lawsuits, attempts at censorship, excommunications, and the firing of BYU professors. By the time the dust settled in the late 1990s, scholars and institutions that had embraced faithful scholarship had achieved a status, and with that status, access to material resources and political clout surpassing that of any other camp on the Mormon intellectual landscape. That in turn put faithful scholars and their supporters in the position to make the most influential Mormon contributions to the mainstreaming of Mormon studies in the opening years of the 21st century. Faithful scholars have dominated the most high-profile Mormon studies conferences staged in mainstream venues, and Orthodox interests have directly or indirectly influenced the efforts to create Mormon studies chairs or programs. This influence operates through three means. First, institutional sponsorship. Institutions supporting faithful scholarship have put up much of the money and done much of the organizing work. The Smith Institute, Farms, and Religious Education were major funders of the 2003 conference at Yale, a fact which gave faithful scholars the leverage to keep D. Michael Quinn off the program. Well, not off the program, but they kept him from presenting. Representatives of those same organizations, plus the Family and Church History Department, presided over the 2005 Joseph Smith Symposium at the Library of Congress, which was in large part a showcase of faithful scholarship funded by LDS Public Affairs. Public Affairs has recently promoted faithful scholarship in response to controversies such as that over Lamanite DNA. And a representative of Public Affairs was instrumental in recruiting members for the council that's raising the funds for Claremont's Mormon Studies Chair. Claremont's success at moving toward making that chair a reality has a lot to do with the goodwill that Dean Karen Torgerson has cultivated at BYU, Public Affairs, and Church Headquarters in Salt Lake. Torgerson has described Claremont's Mormon Studies Chair as a partnership between Claremont and the Church. UVSC and USU have not tried to connect with LDS institutions in the same way. Second, private donors. Orthodox Latter-day Saints who donate money to schools can influence how Mormonism is taught there, a point underscored in a Wall Street Journal article by Daniel Golden earlier this year. Golden reported that at Claremont and Arizona State University, both of those institutions have been unwilling to consider Michael Quinn as a candidate for teaching about Mormonism out of fear of alienating LDS donors. Golden also reported that donors for the Mormon Studies Chair at Claremont want to stipulate that the chair's occupant have access to church archives. If that turns out to be true, it would seem in effect to give the church veto power over the selection of a candidate. Commenting on the role of donors in shaping Jewish studies, one authority has remarked that it would be naive to expect the wishes of the paymaster to have no effect whatever on the direction taken in academic research. Inevitably, the same is true of Mormon studies. Third, LDS politicians. Politicians at both the state and the federal levels can bend discourse about Mormonism at public institutions along Orthodox lines. Fear that state legislators will withhold funding has made UVSC especially sensitive to LDS perceptions of its Mormon studies initiatives, a situation which indirectly gives faithful scholarship considerable influence in setting the standards for acceptable discourse about Mormonism at UVSC. In 2005, for example, UVSC administrators demanded that a conference on Mormonism and social justice be repackaged so as to fly under the radar of vigilant Mormon conservatives. Brian might want to say more about that during his remarks. At the federal level, the influence of LDS lawmakers has helped persuade the Smithsonian Institution to accommodate LDS complaints, for instance, by revising the statement it issues in response to queries about the Book of Mormon. I need to reiterate that faithful scholarship is not the only influence on the mainstreaming of Mormon studies. As you will see represented in the diagram at the bottom of your handout, other forces flow into the contact zone, and some of these push against Orthodox interests. These forces originate both in the LDS intellectual world and in the broader academy. The LDS faculty who are spearheading the Mormon studies initiatives at UVSC and USU do not fit a faithful scholarship profile, and their explanations of how Mormonism will be studied at their institutions invoke ideals of objectivity and neutrality that are actually reminiscent of the new Mormon historians. Fundraising for the Arrington Chair at USU has attracted a cohort of liberal Mormon donors who hope to promote Arrington's style of Mormon scholarship, which they perceive as more open than that promoted by the church or BYU. In addition, concerns within the larger academy about academic freedom and diversity, together with widespread skepticism about Orthodox claims, for instance, about the ancient origins of the Book of Mormon, prevent faithful scholars from presenting their perspective of faith as assertively in mainstream forums as some would like to do. Concerns about academic freedom and diversity also prevent faithful scholars from excluding heterodox Mormon voices from academic venues as thoroughly as some might like to do. At the same time, there are various forces in the academy, especially within the field of religious studies, that encourage sympathetic treatment for faithful scholars. These forces include the perception of Mormons as a persecuted minority, the influence of phenomenologists of religion, who argue that religious studies scholars ought to replicate insiders' accounts of their religions without trying to give naturalistic accounts for what actually happened. 3, post-colonial anxieties about doing violence to people's religious worldviews. And finally, high-profile arguments by religious conservatives, such as the Calvinist historian George Marsden, who used postmodern critiques of the Enlightenment to champion scholarship done from avowedly religious perspectives. All of these academic trends have been important for shaping, for example, Claremont's vision of how to pursue Mormon studies in relationship with the Mormon community, a vision that is congenial to the interests of faithful scholarship, though the limits are still being negotiated. The negotiations required to take Mormon studies mainstream have had an ironic effect on faithful scholarship itself. Looking for ways to meet on common ground with non-Mormon scholars, a number of faithful scholars have begun to make rhetorical moves that recall those made in the 1980s by the New Mormon historians. Some faithful scholars now speak of the need to discuss Mormonism in terms other than those provided by canonical Mormon history. And they acknowledge the value of bracketing off the prophet fraud dilemma. Ironically, when Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander talked about bracketing off the prophet fraud dilemma, or about carving out a middle ground between secularism and tradition, Lewis Midgley and David Bowen accused them of having betrayed the faith. No such accusations have followed now that Richard Bushman and Robert Millett are the ones making those moves. The influence of Orthodox interest in the mainstreaming of Mormon studies is at this point a political given. Like other minority groups, Latter-day Saints seek the validation that comes from being included in the university curriculum. In addition, they are concerned to see that their religion is represented in ways they find congenial, in academia as well as in other public arenas. Several of the recent conferences and other projects that have increased Mormon studies visibility would not have occurred without the support of institutions committed to faithful scholarship. On the other hand, Orthodox influence raises uncomfortable questions. How will academic freedom be assured over against the influence of Orthodox donors and lawmakers? Whose voices are being excluded from the emerging Mormon studies forums, and on what grounds? Where is the line between sympathetic scholarship and public relations or apologetics? Is it in fact possible for a Mormon studies program to simultaneously maintain academic credibility and please a religious community with a history of rather aggressive boundary maintenance? How mainstream institutions negotiate their relationship to faithful scholarship and the interests it represents may be the central challenge for the future of Mormon studies. At the same time, moving into mainstream venues requires faithful scholars to reconsider their agendas and renegotiate their relationship to the recent history of Mormon intellectual politics. It will, at the very least, be interesting to see how all of this unfolds.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to respond to John Charles's comments. I have tremendous respect for John Charles and always enjoy his sessions here at Sunstone and conversations with him in other venues. I want to begin by saying that I essentially agree with his primary thesis, namely that faithful scholarship has had a disproportionate influence in the early forays into secular universities of Mormon studies, at least over the past 5 to 7 years. But his presentation draws some pretty broad brushstrokes that need to be clarified and explained because different institutions have different challenges and have different aims for their programs that need to be taken into account, I think, in better understanding the situation. I think a good way to begin would be to talk about what the ideal Mormon studies program would look like. And I think it goes back to real basic questions in the philosophy of education. As I see it, an ideal Mormon studies program would be committed to the Socratic ideal of dialogue, namely a diversity of voices in conversation, where the conversation is respectful and productive and has a dimension of humility to it, where both sides are willing to listen carefully to the other and to incorporate criticisms and questions into their own work. There should be a kind of introspectiveness to one's own work. So the question then is, how has Mormon studies stacked up against this ideal? Well, as I see it, Over the past 15 to 20 years, it stacked up very poorly. In fact, I would go as far as to say that Mormon studies has been relatively dysfunctional in that regard for 15 years, at least in terms of the conversation that has taken place across ideological and methodological lines. There's been some very fine work, of course, done in Mormon studies. There's been some very poor and embarrassing work done in Mormon studies as well on both sides of the ideological divide. However, though, for the past 5 to 7 years, the chill that has been in place across the ideological divide has begun to thaw. And I think that we're in a period now where Mormon studies is really just trying to get its feet. It doesn't quite know how to get out of the gate. And I think that we're going through a period of fits and starts in trying to understand how to proceed. And John Charles has done a very good job of pointing out some of these challenges. Examples of this are, as John Charles noted, the conference at Yale, which was as interesting sociologically as it was intellectually, in terms of seeing these different personalities and voices in the same room together, in a way that hasn't been the case for 15 or 20 years. I've experienced some of that at UVSC, where we've had the same kind of phenomenon happening. There's some degree of discomfort. People don't know how to respond to each other. There's been such an entrenchment in the way in which people have approached Mormon studies that the social interaction has been very interesting to observe. I think that this thaw, as I refer to it, is really a two-way effort. There's been more of an interest in Mormonism on the part of the mainstream academic community. Mormonism is the fifth largest denomination in the United States. The religious studies community has not paid attention to Mormonism and its dramatic growth. I think that is due in large part to the traditional anti-Mormon bias that has been part of the religious studies community, which emerged out of a theological and divinity background. But that is beginning to change. I also think that there's been more of an interest on the part of the church to mainstream and to be part of the conversation in Mormon studies. And I think that this effort to mainstream slowly into the broader intellectual community has been prompted by efforts like Claremont and possibly UVSC and other projects. So what's the future of Mormon studies? I would say that 20 years from now, we're going to see Mormon studies being much like Catholic studies is now, where it's going to be increasingly mainstreamed into the academic community. There will continue to be challenges, but I think that it's inevitable as the church grows and develops that the academic growth of Mormon studies is going to be there. How CES is going to factor into this remains to be seen. I have no idea what's going to happen there. I don't hold out much hope, but I do believe that independent of CES, Mormon studies is going to go forward and be mainstreamed at an increasing rate. Examples of this recently includes the reorganization of Mormon studies at BYU, bringing all of their projects under the Maxwell Institute. And in a conversation with the new director, Andy Skinner, a couple of months ago, I asked him directly if the reorganization of Mormon studies there at BYU was a response to the project at Claremont of hiring an endowed chair in Mormon studies. And his response was very interesting. He paused for about 5 seconds and said, "I don't want to say that it was a reaction to what happened at Claremont, but this reorganization certainly is recognizes the future of Mormon studies." So questions remain as to how things are going to develop at BYU, but they certainly recognize that things are happening elsewhere, and I think that they have finally decided that they need to get into the game somehow. How that will take place remains to be seen. All right, so I think what I'll do now is just spend a couple of minutes talking about the two programs I know best, Claremont Graduate University and Utah Valley State College. And I want to talk about Claremont first. As you heard in the introduction, I'm a Claremont graduate and have retained very close ties to the institution and have served somewhat as an informal consultant to the dean and the associate dean in trying to negotiate how to approach this Mormon Studies chair. It's very important to understand that the endowed chair in Mormon Studies at Claremont is part of a larger program there to create chairs, courses, and to organize conferences in a way where there is interface with the religious community. In the case of Mormon Studies, it happens to be more with the institutional church than it would be in the case of, say, Catholic Studies, even, where what Claremont's position is that they want to have dialogue and input from the faith community, whatever form that takes, for whatever tradition they happen to be interfacing with. And so, in addition to the Mormon Studies chairs, there's a Jewish Studies Council, a Catholic Studies Council, an Islamic Studies Council, and, surprisingly, a Zoroastrian Studies Council, a Protestant Studies Council, and two or three others. And they're all in varying degrees of progress. The Mormon Studies effort is the farthest along. The Islamic Studies is coming along well, and they will begin fundraising for a chair very soon. At least that's the last I heard. So the idea is that the councils serve as consultants, and the councils are made up of representatives from the faith community, and they can be made up of church leaders or other ecclesiastical leaders, scholars from the community, possibly wealthy patrons, interested donors. These councils vary depending on which one we're talking about. And it's important to understand that Claremont is responding to the broader religious studies community. And the situation in the broader religious studies community has been the decrease of dialogue with faith communities. In fact, many religious studies scholars believe that it's a detriment to religious studies to maintain a healthy dialogue with faith communities due to the danger of undue influence from the community. And so Claremont is responding to that kind of a situation, and so what they're doing is rather innovative and risky, and they recognize all of the potential dangers that come with it. I've tried to make sure that they make sure they're going in with their eyes wide open. That's been part of my job. However, it's important to understand that they want to make sure that we don't confuse having a religious voice in religious studies with having religious voices control the conversation. Okay, that's a distinction that was made to me by the associate dean as we conversed a few days ago about this. Whether or not that is going to play itself out again remains to be seen. We'll have to watch. Another important thing about Claremont is that it's a secular university that has historic ties to a theology school. Okay, so it's a very interesting situation. There's a very close relationship between the Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. There's faculty swapping. Students can take 4-credit courses at either school. And that also, excuse me, informs the way in which religious studies is approached. So there's much more of an emphasis on theology and ethics and culture, say, than with other traditional religious studies programs at, say, UNC Chapel Hill or Temple or other programs. Okay, now, in the case of Claremont, it's really interesting that it's a kind of mixed bag what's been going on. Because on the one hand, as John Charles pointed out, there have been overtures from Claremont that Mike Quinn would likely not be a strong candidate for the position, which in my mind is lamentable and regrettable. I believe Claremont should have maintained a position in which they said that any qualified person would be strongly considered for the position, and these early overtures about Mike Quinn have been regrettable. But on the flip side, it's interesting to note that in the Sunstone program, you have an advertisement from the Hunter Foundation asking for donations from this community to the chair, okay, which is interesting at least symbolically, if not substantially. Okay, so some of these traditional divides are being problematized in a way that I think is very healthy. Okay, now let me talk about UVSC and then we'll open it up for questions. In contrast to Claremont, UVSC is a state college located in Utah County, and most of you don't need an introduction to Utah County. It's arguably the most conservative county and the most conservative state in the nation. So we have particular issues that Claremont doesn't have to deal with, nor even Utah State University, in it, and given its history and its situation. As John Charles pointed out, we have no official contact with the church, although we're happy to respond to their queries, which occasionally come to us as the result of inviting a speaker or hosting a conference. UVSC is committed to the ideal, to the Socratic ideal I mentioned above. We believe that we've done a pretty good job of fostering the kind of productive dialogue I think is necessary in Mormon studies. For example, the list of people we've had speak on our campus includes many of the people John Charles pointed out: Terrell Givens, Jan Shipps, Mike Quinn, Robert Millett, Margaret Toscano, Jill Durr, Armand Moss, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that we have had on our campus the range of voices in Mormon studies that you would hope to see in dialogue with each other. And as I pointed out, conversations have taken place on our campus that haven't taken place in many, many years, and it's very heartening to see this happening. I don't think that one can accuse Utah Valley State College of being unduly influenced by faithful scholarship, and I think one solid piece of evidence in support of that argument is the fact that Dennis Potter has been the program coordinator in Mormon studies at UVSC for the past 5 years. And anyone who knows Dennis Potter knows that he's the last person who would cave to the interests of faithful scholarship. So having Dennis Potter as the program coordinator at Mormon Studies at UVSC has been very interesting, because what you have is a perpetual situation of negotiation between ourselves, the administration, and our colleagues on campus and others. John Charles talked about the Mormonism and Social Justice Conference. And he is correct that the president called Dennis into his office and asked us if we would repackage the conference. I think that was his term. That's right, Dennis. And the situation was this. Local legislators had earmarked $3.5 million for UVSC. We happened to organize the conference the last day of the legislative session in which this was going to be approved. Our president was concerned in a preemptive way, that there was going to be some early publicity regarding the Mormonism and Social Justice Conference. You know, UVSC hosts Mormon feminist critics or something like that. He was scared of that kind of a headline. So he was interested in repackaging the conference in a way that would not catch the attention of the press that might impact this $3.5 million earmark. It was a very, very uncomfortable set of negotiations that took place over a period of a couple of days, but the outcome was something that we felt like that we could live with in a way that did not do undue violence to academic freedom. So our position in response to the president was that that none of the content of the conference was to be impacted by the repackaging. Any change of titles of sessions that he suggested would only agree to that if the presenter agreed to do it and if they suggested the renaming of the session. And that was the compromise we felt like we could live with the alternative being canceling the conference altogether. So this was one of those uncomfortable moments in our history where there was negotiation and there was compromise. The question is, was it a compromise of principles that we couldn't live with? And both Dennis and I felt that we had to live with these compromises given the alternatives. Neither of us were very happy about it. But it turns out that the conference went very well. It was a strong conference. All of the speakers that we had invited presented, and even some additional people were invited as a result of the negotiation. So the future is, I think, bright for Mormon studies, but I don't think it's going to be without its challenges, and I don't think that we should deceive ourselves into thinking that this is going to go forward in a way that doesn't have the kinds of tensions that we've seen in the past. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have reason to be optimistic. Thank you.
Okay, we do have some good time left for some questions. I would like to start by just asking John Charles to elaborate, if he can, on one little detail that he alluded to, which was the dissolution of the Smith Institute. Many of us have been so familiar with that over the years since the dissolution of Camelot. Some years ago, and Brian alluded to the reorganization under the Maxwell Institute. John Charles, do you see that as particularly significant in this whole game, and would you like to elaborate on it? And then after John Charles says whatever he wants to there, we'll invite anyone who has a question to come up and please use this microphone so we'll get it on the tape and we'll just engage in a discussion.
I have no inside scoop to offer about the dissolution of the Smith Institute. I know about it simply what's already in the public record. They were shut down, and their faculty were sort of transferred, some of them to BYU and some taken back up to church headquarters, which for people in the Smith Institute was sort of like a triumphal return. You know, we're coming back after the Camelot exile. But my understanding as to what fueled it was, first of all, the sense that they weren't producing very much, and certainly by comparison to Farms, they weren't. And so I think the comparison with Farms was very bad for them. They weren't producing as much. They weren't producing nothing with the celebrity status of the Dead Sea Scrolls Project, for example. The big thing they were putting the basket they were putting their eggs in was the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And my understanding is that the desire to move that project and faculty back up to church headquarters was a desire. This is from public statements by, I believe, Marlon Jensen, a desire to sort of make sure that they were staying on task, it was being done in a cost-efficient way, Larry Miller was funding it, he wanted bang for his buck, Marlon Jensen said. So I think it was partly about control, making sure there was good administrative control of that project. But yeah, ultimately what happened was that they just weren't producing enough to justify, in the eyes of the administration, continuing to fund it.
Dennis. Okay, Hardy, and then Dennis, and then Robert.
This is to Brian, but you can answer it too. Do you want an institution without tension? Would it be a good thing for scholarship if you didn't have any tension whatsoever? You decried it right at the end, said you didn't. You're uncomfortable with the tension, but would it really be good for scholarship not to have any tension?
That's a great question. The Socratic ideal that I appealed to necessarily involves there to be tension, but the tension should be between ideas, not necessarily a tension of power relations between administrators, donors, legislators, and others. I would much rather have the tension be between Jill Durr and Margaret Toscano arguing certain aspects of feminist theology than us having to trot up to the president's office justify and explain ourselves. So that, yeah, I like tension, in fact, if it's a kind of creative and healthy and productive tension. So I think that's a really important distinction to make. But that's a very good question. Thanks.
Brian described what happened accurately, but I wanted to add on, so this is a comment that you can respond to. Just to make clear about, you know, just to make things a little clearer, I think. When I first went into the president's office, I was pissed. I mean, really pissed. And I made it very clear to him that I was. I was angry. And when he told me that he was thinking about canceling the conference, I said, "You do that, I'm going to the media. The liberal Mormon community is going to jump down your throat. They're going to make a big deal about this." And he said, "Good. I want them to, because that'll make me look good in the eyes of the political conservatives that I'm worried about." So this was a very, very tense political meeting. I'm making good on that, aren't I? I told him I would do it, and I'm doing that, and I've done it like 3 or 4 times now. And if I had tenure, I wouldn't have compromised at all, period. I would have walked out of the office and said, "You do what you want, and I'll fight you to the, you know." But I didn't have tenure, and I couldn't do that. And I have to say that I wasn't defended very well by the dean or by the vice president of academic affairs, who behind the scenes told me that they were totally supportive of me. But in the actual meeting, they were deferring to him in this kind of weird way that I see in the Mormon context a lot. And the dean's not even Mormon. The president's not Mormon. And it was really, really very strange sort of circumstance. It was very, very frustrating. The compromise that we came to in the end, I was happy with, but I thought it was really funny too, because, for example, one title was changed from "The Spiritual Pilgrimage of Gay and Lesbian Saints" to "Pastoral Care for Members with Special Needs." And the reason that was Richley Crapo and the anthropologist from Utah State University, and as soon as he found out about what was going on, I think that he wanted to come up with a humorous change, because he knew about those politics, because the same kind of thing had happened at Utah State before. So the fact that there was voluntary changes of titles comes from the fact that there's a general background pressure. And everyone who was involved knows about that general background pressure, and they knew that they needed to do this. I think if we had had some more out-of-state scholars who weren't used to this, they might have been much more reluctant to change the titles. And I need to correct one thing, and that is this. In one case, there was a title change that turned out to be involuntary, because it was a panel, and I didn't ask every member of the panel. I was the one who organized the panel, and I was on the panel, so I thought since I was okay with the title change, everyone else would be. But David Knowlton was also on that panel, and he wasn't okay with the title change. So, and that was my fault, though. That wasn't the president's fault. So I just wanted to make that correction. Oh, it was a title that involved the word liberation theology, and we changed it to economic justice or something like that.
As a member of the Claremont Council on Mormon Studies, I wanted to say, one, I appreciate the concern about what is happening to Mormon studies. I have grown up in the church where no one took Mormon studies very seriously, either in or out of the church. And so it's, to me, refreshing that a number of other believers are interested in and committed to examining Mormonism, and in ways that I think will be very helpful. I think that in some ways the best thing about what's happening in secular universities is that it does make people at church institutions more responsible and make them understand that this is whatever discussion that takes place about Mormonism takes place within a broader context, and that it is not that they don't own nor control the dialogue. On the other hand, I think that it's we're going to live, I'm with Brian, hoping that that we come to a time when the tension really is ideological tension among scholarly points of view, rather than with these other things intruding and being part of it. But I think it's probably a necessary part of the transition that we are in. If we look back, we've come a very long way. If we look forward, we have a long way to go. I believe that the fact that Karen Torgerson at Claremont, the dean of religion there, is very interested in the kind of dialogue that Brian talked about, a serious dialogue among scholars of various traditions. It is her wish that Mormons and Muslims and Mormons and Catholics and others have these significant dialogues, which it seems to me the world will benefit from because they are likely to produce important light. I'm part of the Book of Mormon Roundtable, and we had a conversation Wednesday night over at the library about the Book of Mormon. And what was really encouraging to me about that dialogue is that there were people from other religious traditions who were taking the Book of Mormon seriously, not as an historical document, but as a sacred text. And for me to have arrived at a point where we were not simply defending the Book of Mormon and, on the one hand, or having it completely ignored on the other, is a quantum leap. So I think that we are, and speaking from my personal point of view as someone on the Claremont Council, I think it's regrettable that anyone associated with Claremont made any statement about any potential candidate, because it is the point of view, I think, of at least some of us, and I hope the majority of us on that council, that there is no commitment except to good scholarship, to important openness to scholarly voices, and that I certainly have not made any decision, and I don't think anyone else has made any decision about who should be on that, who should fill that chair. I would like also to dispel what I think are consistent rumors that a decision has already been made, and that there are already two or three people who have the inside track on that position. That position, from my point of view as somebody on that council, and I think I certainly represent the majority, no decision is made, no commitment has been made to anyone, or either in terms of their who they are or where they're coming from. Realistically, there's probably not an enormous body of people who might fill that, but I think there's some awfully good candidates who, among whom hopefully one will be chosen to fill that. But I see something else happening at Claremont, which is a continuing dialogue about what it means to have a program of Mormon studies in a secular university.
A quick response to something that, inspired both by what Bob was just saying and by what Brian had said a little earlier, and then we'll turn it over to the next question. The ideal of dialogue is very nice. I would like that. I would like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. But I think that we need to be kind of pragmatic about this too. The ideal of dialogue can be subverted by all kinds of different interests. And I'm both, you know, intellectually interested in and politically troubled by the potential for the way in which the interest that faithful scholarship represents can misuse the idealistic desire for dialogue to promote ends that I'm not particularly interested in promoting.
I think that there'd be misuse on either end of it.
Sure, but I'm not worried about
yours. That's a very good point. One thing that I would add to that is that you constantly have to be vigilant and you have to be realistic. But each of us is thrown into a set of circumstances, a lot of which is not of our own making. And that's our situation at UVSC. So the question is, given the circumstances you're in, given the political realities and the situation, given the administration, politics, your colleagues on campus, other scholars in the community, your own research interests, how can you move ahead? And how much compromise can you make before you give up or impact your own academic principles and the ideal that I was talking about? These are tough things. But you have to have an ideal in mind. You can't only be pragmatic. You have to have an ideal in mind. You have to have principles that you're committed to in the dialogue. I wanted to add to something Bob said earlier about Claremont. It's important to understand that the council made up of Latter-day Saints is not going to be doing the hiring of the chair. It's going to be a university hire that is going to be voted on by the faculty in the School of Religion at Claremont. And so all of these other interests on the part of the faculty are going to come to bear. The school has made it clear, and you, Bob can correct me if I'm wrong, the school has made it clear that they want the voice of the council involved, but that it is only a voice. And the last I heard, there was some talk about a member of the council, at least one, being on the search committee, but as a non-voting member. Bob, is that correct?
The recruitment and hiring of this particular position will be like the hiring and recruitment of any other position within the Claremont academic structure. So it is a faculty-controlled decision. And I think Claremont is very clear about the fact that this cannot be. It would subvert the whole idea of having a program in Mormon studies if this were somehow controlled by faithful scholars or faithful scholarship or those people who were vested in somehow making this a church position. Again, coming to something that you said, I think that negotiation between the integrity of our principles and the realities we have to confront is something we are constantly doing as human beings. I think it's also true to say that that's one of the things the council is constantly doing, is evaluating that. Do you want to, if the price of having a Mormon studies program is too high, it's not worth having. If the compromise is too great on either side, it wouldn't happen. So how do you find that ground in which you can meet the needs both of an academic secular university and its integrity and the wish of Latter-day Saints, some of whom fit within a spectrum of faithful to perhaps more liberal or more progressive, who also want this, and how do you do that? And I think in some sense it is a compromise, but hopefully it's not a compromise of fundamental principles and integrity. And I think that's what we're trying to accomplish at Claremont, and I hope, you have very different realities in Utah County. I can't imagine in some ways a more difficult place to set up Mormon studies, and it's ironic that would be the case, and it's terrible the kind of problems that Gene England and other people had in trying to create a program at UBSC that would do what has to be done.
Well, I have to begin with an apology because I missed a good part of John Charles' presentation, but fortunately I found the handout which encapsulates a lot of what I assume you presented. I give the apology because this is absolutely fascinating as a historical overview that I personally have lived a lot of as a beginning anthropologist struggling to make sense of myself and my world and writing about Mormonism in a profession where there wasn't much interest in Mormonism and where the work was troubled from within a Mormon studies perspective because of these broader debates you're bringing out. But out of that, I come with a couple of concerns that I'm just going to speak straightforwardly. First of all, it seems to me that the history of what you're describing as the sort of hegemony of faithful scholarship at BYU has some interesting sequelae. One is at UVSC. Many of those scholars went to UVSC, including Gene England. And in some ways, UVSC's Mormon Studies program is a direct result of what happened at BYU. And it's not just Eugene England, it's Scott Abbott, it's Sam Rushforth, it's the academic freedom people who fought at BYU who came to UVSC in the aftermath of the Mormon Studies conference and other things that occurred that very same semester around President Cederberg's struggle with the legislature and his attempts to kind of corral what he saw as difficulties with the faculty. The BYU faculty, former BYU faculty, served as a focus for organizing UVSC's faculty and giving a very strong resistance to Cederberg and a very strong aftermath of holding his feet actually to the fire over what happened in the Mormon Studies Conference, but not just there. It was also over his broader emphasis that UVSC faculty needed to be aware of community values and somehow tone themselves down for community values. He got hit really hard by the faculty, and the key to that, and it's not just there, it was also in the hiring of Cederberg, where UVSC's former BYU faculty was very clear and very strongly organized to keep BYU faculty who had been involved with the Academic Freedom debacle from becoming the president at UVSC. And that organization was critical. And so there is another sequela, another consequence, and that is the UVSC. And I think part of that is actually my own hiring at UVSC, although I was hired in an academic track, not in a Mormon studies track. And here comes another personal appointment that I see missing from this chart and I think is important here. And that is that many of us who were forced out by the faithful people, you know, I have to say that whole thing of being accused of being a secularist at BYU still troubles me because I never have been a secularist. I'm very troubled by secularism. And the dualism left very little room to maneuver. And it was the dualism in a lot of ways was very painful and really troubling. And I find that dualism reproduced here. So let me give a third to the dualism. And that third is that many of us found other academic venues, other places. Myself, you know, I found home in the growth of the Society for the Anthropology of Religion that was new and developing. And I found home in the growth of religious studies in Mexico. That ultimately those two things led to me being hired back at UVSC and the development of other places for Mormon studies within anthropology. And I suspect other scholars have found these other individual places that may not be the big ones like Claremont or may not be the ones that are really dominant here. But this is a third that I don't know, maybe it's just my own personal bias I'd like to see represented.
Thank you to both of our speakers and those who have contributed from the audience. A very valuable discussion, and our time is up for now, but I'm sure these gentlemen will be glad to engage you in conversation. Thank you for being here.